Okay. I hear you're the president of
OFB. Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to this informational hearing of the House Committee on Higher Education. The purpose of this hearing will be to learn more and to ask questions of those involved with two bills that we're dealing with this session. The first is House Bill 1581, that is the bill having to do with the Oregon Education Investment Board, the Chief Education Officer, and the Achievement Compact. And for that hearing, we're going to have two panels of invited testimony. The first will be Tim Nesbitt, and along with Nancy Golden and David Reeves. And then we'll have a second panel, which will have Hannah Vandering, Jim Salt, and Betsy Miller-Jones. Okay. We will then move to our second bill, which is Senate Bill 1538. That's the bill having to do with the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. It's a kind of update of last session's Senate Bill 242. And for that, we will also have two panels. We'll have Tim Nesbitt again with Bridget Burns and Andrea Henderson, and then another panel with Cindy Hunt, Josette Green, and Jim Marquis. Following those two sets of invited testimony on the bills, we'll be opening it up to public testimony, and there we'll take people's testimony in the order in which they've signed up. Except for people who have come a really long way, we'll try to get them up first. Okay. So that is that's the plan for today. I do want to say that following this hearing, we will have a break of 15 minutes, and then there will be an information session on the subject of tuition equity, getting some updates and other information about the issue of tuition equity. And but that is not part of this hearing. It will be 15 minutes after this hearing closes.
Mr. Chair, and that's unrelated to this committee as well, right?
That is unrelated to this committee. It's open to all members. But it's not part of this committee. So with that, I'm going to open an informational hearing on Senate Bill 1581. And if we could have Tim Nesbitt, Nancy Golden, David Reeves come up. And colleagues, Senate Bill 1581 comes to us from the Senate. Actually, it doesn't come to us. It went from us directly to the Ways and Means Committee. So having this informational hearing is our chance to hear directly from those who've been working on the bill and to ask any questions that we have regarding it. So please feel free to ask the questions that you feel you need to ask. So Tim, would you open up and
introduce
yourself, please?
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tim Nesbitt, manager of the Governor's Oregon Education Investment Project and staff to the Oregon Education Investment Board. And I'm pleased to be able to present to you today the legislation from the Oregon Education Investment Board designed to advance the concepts you enacted in the last session with Senate Bill 909 and Senate Bill 253.
Excuse me, Tim. Actually, you don't need to be that close to the mic. These have gotten very sensitive, so you can just speak from a distance.
And those bills, of course, are intended to put us on a path to achieve success for all students. Those bills created, in particular, the new Oregon Education Investment Board, and you'll be hearing from several members of the board, both as part of this panel and the following panel, and established the goal of 40-40-20 for high school and college completion. Following that, in the interim, with the appointment of the board and the work that they put into delivering their report to you in December, the governor and the board then introduced two bills. One, House Bill 4165, is focused on early childhood and kindergarten readiness. And that is getting a hearing and I think a work session tomorrow in one of the Ways and Means subcommittees. The legislation here today to discuss with you, Senate Bill 1581, offers what we think are the best next steps to build a unified education system that extends from early childhood to college and career readiness under the leadership of a chief education officer, establishes a framework for accountability and investing for outcomes through the creation of achievement compacts, and in regard to both of those goals, sets a laser focus on high school and college completion. As you know, Senate Bill 253 set the bar as high as any state in the nation to ensure that by the year 2025, 40% of Oregonians have a four-year degree or better, 40% have a two-year degree or post-secondary certificate, and the remaining 20% have at least a high school diploma. So let me start, before I walk through the provisions of Senate Bill 1581, with two thoughts about those 40-40-20 goals that inform our proposals in this legislation. First, a 100% high school completion rate may seem more of a motivating aspiration than an achievable goal, but it's not possible to know at this point what number is achievable for high school completion with what level of funding over the next 13 years. To those who'd say that we're shooting too high, we'd say next year's kindergartners will be the class of 2025. And I don't think any of us as adults would want to walk into a kindergarten classroom next September and deliver a prediction to those students that only two-thirds of them will be successful in graduating from high school on time, or any lesser number than 100% will be our target for those children. So we think it's very appropriate to be focused on 100% high school completion and to be making progress every step of the way over the next 13 years, starting in the next school year. Second, we recognize that we will need additional resources to achieve our 40-40-20 goals, but we really cannot say how much more we might need. We have a quality education model that tells us we have roughly two-thirds of the funding we need to achieve success for 90% of our students in K-12. We're funding that at roughly two-thirds of the QEM rate, and we're seeing roughly two-thirds of our high school students graduate on time. One might call that some validation of the QEM, but where our districts are in terms of high school completion is all over the map. We have some districts graduating more than 90% of their students on time, others struggling to graduate 50%, all spending roughly the same dollars per student. Some of these variations can be explained by the challenges that accompany poverty and racial disparities in English as a second language, but not all. We have one large district, Tigard-Tualatin, which graduated 82.5% of its high school students on time last year. Its student demographics look just like those of the state as a whole. Its spending per student was at 99.3% of the statewide average for all districts. Yet it is achieving an on-time high school graduation rate of 82.5% versus a statewide average of 67.2%. If all school districts could match that result, the gap between where we are now and 100% high school completion for 2025 would shrink by almost half, from 33 points to 17 points, with no change in state funding. Now, we can't say that Tigard-Tualatin is a perfect surrogate for the state as a whole, even though its student population looks just like the student population statewide in terms of race, students in poverty, and English language learners. But its experience can be both exemplary and informative. And it's by comparing achievement from district to district, looking for what is comparable and what is exceptional, that we can begin to learn what works best in our schools and what can work better in comparable districts. Tigard-Tualatin has taken its response to intervention program to other districts with additional support from the state. Similar learn from what's working interventions can pave the path to improvement throughout the state. And these are the insights that inform the recommendations we bring to you from the Oregon Education Investment Board that are reflected in the provisions of Senate Bill 1581. I'd like to walk through those provisions for you. We've just provided a summary. And then I'd like to have you hear from Superintendent Nancy Golden, who will share her experience in developing a model compact for Springfield and what we're looking at for other K-12 districts, and David Reeves, who teaches at Portland Community College and will speak about the post-secondary experience. In the handout you have, you see a summary beginning with the first 13 sections of the bill, which are related to the authority of the Chief Education Officer, a position created in Senate Bill 909. A job description for that position is attached. This went through 12 drafts after many meetings, a lot of outreach by the investment board, and you see there a more detailed two-page description of what that job encompasses, the experience and qualifications desired, including leadership, change agent experience, systems experience, and education experience. And you'll see at the bottom of that page that there's a contact point there for our recruitment firm. It's a national firm who we retained to do the search and recruitment and work with the governor's screening panel to bring a finalist forward to the board, we hope by April, for consideration for this position. But first, we, in this bill, are asking for your approval and attempting to answer the question posed in Senate Bill 909 about what authority the Chief Education Officer should have. The term used in Senate Bill 909 was direction and control. So we've adopted that term, but we're also clarifying that direction and control does not mean appointing authority, does not mean hire and fire authority. What we're asking for here is the authorization of the legislature for the Chief Education Officer to have that direction and control authority for related to the design and organization of the state's P20 education system over the positions listed. Those are the Commissioner for Community College Services, the Chancellor of OUS, the Executive Director of OSAC, when that position is filled, the Early Childhood System Director, when that position is filled, as well as the Executive Director of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, when that position is filled. We do have a Director of OSAC currently, and you'll be hearing from her shortly, and the Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction, when that's effective under Senate Bill 552. Those are what's encompassed in Sections 1 through 13 of the bill. In Sections 14 of the bill, 14 through 20, you see detailed the proposal for the establishment of achievement compacts between the state on behalf of the Oregon Education Investment Board on behalf of the state and all of our education entities beginning in the next school year, 2012-13. Those would extend to all 197 K-12 school districts, our 19 education service districts, our 17 community college districts, the university system, and the 7 universities, as well as OHSU for its health professions and graduate programs. The achievement compacts, as specified in this legislation, would be adopted by these education entities at the time they adopt their budgets. So it's our hope, and the investment board is working on this, that we'll have these achievement compacts ready to go by the end of March if this legislation is approved, and all of the districts would receive them by April 1. So they can then, in the months remaining between then and the end of this fiscal year, between April 1 and June 30, they can adopt their achievement compacts in the process by which they adopt their budgets. This would mean that for the first time, all of our educational entities in the state would be adopting an outcomes focus when it comes to adopting their budgets, of trying to align their investments with the most significant high-level outcomes for student success. What those outcomes are, the terms of the compacts, would be determined by the investment board, but left to the individual entities to fill in terms of setting their targets. The framework envisioned in the legislation basically has three categories. Completion, as we talked about earlier, high school and college completion. Quality of knowledge and skills, or content, so that we can be confident that the knowledge and skills represented by a diploma or a degree are in fact valid and in line with the Common Core standards in K-12 and the rigor we expect from our post-secondary institutions. And as well, that there is connections across the continuum, so that community colleges are looking back to the high schools and working with high schools on how their students are prepared to succeed at the college level, and how our colleges are also looking beyond, for instance, to employers, so we know whether students are successful after they leave college and have their degrees. The compacts would also specify numbers and percentages for disadvantaged student groups, and those would be part of the compact as well. OHS Youth Compact, by the way, would be limited to the enrollment and attainment of degrees by Oregon residents in the programs for which the state is funded. They're something of an exception. We would also note in all the compacts the level of funding indicated by the quality education model, so we'll be able to start correlating both so that districts can be informed by that level of funding and we'll also be able to start correlating results to what that model tells us we might expect.
That's for K-12, right?
That's for K-12. We would also ensure that in order for these compacts to work, to really have meaningful impact at the school level, we know that we're going to need the involvement of educators. We see that a lot now already with school improvement plans and continuous improvement plans. What this legislation proposes is at the K-12 level to have the Achievement Compact Advisory Committees established. Those would begin working with superintendents and school boards to achieve the targets set by school boards and their achievement compacts in the coming year. And then as that work is done in the coming year, that will help to inform the setting of targets in subsequent years. So we see the achievement compacts launched in the latter part of this fiscal year between April and June with the school boards and other governing boards setting the targets, and then processes in place during the school year which are focused on the accomplishment of those targets, the achievement of those goals, and in subsequent years also informing the setting of targets for those following years. We have also provided for open communications with parents, students, teachers, faculty, and employees, just as we have now with the school improvement plan process, and have provided to the OEIB a timeline and a method for them to further refine what the year-end reports, the reporting of achievement, would look like from each of the districts. We are trying to stay in tune with the concept of tight loose, where the state as investor is focused on the most meaningful outcomes for educational system at the highest level, but is loose on leaving to the districts as much flexibility as possible to innovate, to reflect local values, community direction, and achieve according to their best ability. That would mean that in addition, we are trying to free up some of the existing reporting burdens that now apply. In K-12, that would mean districts no longer having to file a Division 22 report, at least not in the next fiscal year. It would also mean that we'd work and through the OEIB try to identify ways in which school districts can be relieved of some of the continuous improvement plan processes. Some of those are dictated by federal law. Others are in state law and can be loosened and enable schools to focus on achieving the goals they set in their achievement compacts rather than necessarily reporting on a process now set in federal and state law. We have provided as well for districts in both K-12 and post-secondary to give further feedback to the board by September 30th of this year on models for collaboration and professional development, which would help guide the framing of achievement compacts in subsequent years. Those are in section 18 and 19. And we have in section 20 the specific authorization for the board to enter into achievement compacts. Other sections you'll see reflect the fact that under current law, which we're not proposing to change in this legislation, the Oregon Education Investment Board would sunset in March of 2016. And so some of these things are enacted and then subject to that same sunset. What we envision is that with the hiring of the chief education officer and plans already put in place by the investment board, separate from the achievement compacts, a lot more work will be done in the remainder of this year, led by the chief education officer, to do that design and build out of the P20 system, where the goal is not just better coordination across the continuum from early childhood to post-secondary, but also to free up resources, which we're confident we can do, to better support teaching and learning. The one consistent theme we heard from our outreach and consultation with superintendents and educators around the state is that in K-12, they would like to see more support from the state via the Department of Education and less focus on compliance reporting and regulation. That's something which will be a goal of the effort led by the Chief Education Officer to design that and implement that P20 system. That process will lead, we believe, to further legislation that will come to you in 2013 about what that system may look like. And the governor and the board have adopted a goal of ensuring that for our post-secondary institutions, for OUS in particular, we end up with one entity. We're now going to have a higher education coordinating commission as well as a higher education board. We want to end up with one entity overseeing the university system. So that will be part of the work done and led by the chief education officer. I will be happy to provide more information and answer questions, but I think this is a good time to segue to Superintendent Nancy Golden and David Reeves, and they can fill in more of the details for you about how this is taking shape in our K-12 school districts and in our post-secondary education.
That's great, Tim. Thank you for that, the walkthrough of the major sections of the bill. And so, Nancy and David, if you could just give us kind of a brief overview of you know, what you have to say, and then I'm sure that there are questions out here, and then we can open that up to all three of you.
Okay. Representative Denbrough, co-chair Denbrough and co-chair Johnson, members of the committee. I'm Nancy Golden. I'm superintendent of Springfield Public Schools, and I want to focus on the K-12 Achievement Compact. In the first week in March, we're going to be having about 1,000 kindergartners come and think about coming to Springfield Public Schools next year, and they'll all receive a budget, that, a button that says graduating class of 2025. So our job's to get all of them there. We're not just giving two-thirds of them buttons. We're giving them all buttons. So, and I believe strongly that the achievement compacts are really going to help us make sure our students move across that pathway to successfully meeting the 40-40-20 goals. So earlier, I was asked to put together kind of a model of how we would do it in Springfield Public Schools. A lot of people were asking what this would look like, and because I've been involved in this for the last few years, I volunteered along with a few other people to just share what it could look like in Springfield. I want you to know the work's evolved since this. I'm chairing a subcommittee of the Oregon Education Investment Board, where we're really looking at what will the final compact look like. But this is, and you do have that in your packet, our best thinking at this time, but this just gives you sort of a district perspective. And what I want to say first is that the compact is data, but for most districts, I feel confident they're going to put this in a bigger framework of how do you use this achievement compact to really think about in your district how you're going to deliver curriculum and instruction for so our students will be successful. So you should all have this handout now. And I want to begin by just sharing a process we would be using in Springfield. And what you'll see in this process is that it really talks about the 40-40-20 goals and working with our associations. That's our Administrative Association, our Springfield Education Association, and our Classified Association, to really determine the targets and the strategies. What we know is it is the teachers who and instructional assistants who are going to deliver the strategies, so it's very important they're involved in the development of that. What you'll also see on this chart is that once we've analyzed our data, set our targets, have strategies, we're going to go to our budget committee, because we believe strongly that our budget committee needs to budget a plan, that plan a budget. And so when they see what our strategies are, that will be useful information as they determine the budget for the school district. So that's just the process. But I think more important is page 2, 3, and 4. And what you'll see on these pages are that we're not just getting students to the 40-40-20 goals. We have to get them career and college ready. And so our instructional framework is very much using the work of David Conley, which says there's four sets of really important skills. The first one are cognitive skills. Those are all the thinking skills we know about, research, problem formulation, interpretation. There's key content. That's just the core content. And then there's learning skills, such as self-advocacy, setting goals, and key transition skills. The transition skills are, do students believe they can go to college? Do they know how to look for scholarships? Do they know how to advocate for themselves? Are they in a college-going environment? So if you look at the next page, to me this is where it gets really exciting. So on this next page, what you'll see is this would be actually kind of like a report, not a report card, but a document we would give to our families. Because think about now, what we do in the state. We, in the newspaper, and we send home the parents, your child's a 213 on a test. That doesn't mean much to parents. They don't understand that. But if you look at this, what this is showing is in the key cognitive skill area, if you're in that gray box, it means you're on track to be career and college ready. So if you look at the student, Griffin Coleman, what you will see in terms of his ACT, which is an alternative to the SAT, he's career and college ready. The CPAS, which would be a measure we don't do yet but we're thinking of doing, he exceeds. You start seeing in every single category, this student is either on track or exceeds on track. If I was a parent and received a report like this, it would mean a whole lot to me, because if my child wasn't in that gray bar, I would be at school saying, how are we going to get him in the gray bar or beyond? So and then if you look at the next page, this is page 4. What it does is take those same measures, but it puts it in a circle saying these measures say you're on track for a 4-year college, these say 2-year college, and these say you could graduate with a certificate or go into the world of work. So again, I think these achievement compacts allow us to start communicating with parents in a very different way, so they really understand how successful are we in getting their students to the 40-40-20 goals. So if you look at the next page, page 5, what you'll see is this is an example of how we would set our goals. So at the very top it says SPS, it's Springfield Public Schools goals for 40-40-20. And if you look at 24-25, when we have to have 40-40, and the 15-5%, of some of our students will get certificates of completion, or it's about 5%, so we want to make sure those students get reach every goal they can too. We've just designed backwards to create our targets of what we would need each year. Again, this just is taking what those different data points would mean. So then, go ahead to, if you just flip 2 pages, it says draft K-12 achievement compact measures. This actually, so it kind of looks like this. It's 2 pages. You can see the teacher in me, right? Kind of looks like this. And what you would see there is actually putting Springfield's current data into the achievement compact. So we have our actual data, what we're projected to do, and then a 2012-13 targets. And then, of course, it's just a matter of getting the right strategies to get to the targets. So this is just an example of what an achievement compact could look like. I wanted to talk a little bit about how the work's moved forward on the subcommittee. First of all, I want you to know I just presented to our Lane ESD, to the 16 superintendents. I'm just thrilled how engaged we all are in talking about achievement compacts and meeting the 40-40-20 goal. It's a much deeper conversation than we've had in the last few years about helping students reach their goals. But what I would say, as we've sort of brought this in front of various groups, we realize there's been confusion about what is student-level data. That would be data that schools would create more for curriculum and instruction, so formative data. That's not the job of the achievement compact. Or there's priority, focus, and model designations. That comes through the Title I mandate. And when you have a school that is not meeting targets, they're priority, or you need to focus, or some can become models. So that's not what the achievement compact is supposed to do. And you have the school and district report card, and those are different. They have different data. What an achievement compact's really about is the policymakers. This is at the state level and at the district levels, guiding the budget and the policy conversations, or setting policy and guiding the state budget to help improve instruction at that appropriate level. So this is very broad, and but very important to us in achieving goals for our students.
Thanks, Nancy.
Yeah. Dave. Co-chairs Johnson and Dembro. I'm David Reeves. I teach English as a second language at Portland Community College. I'm president of American Federation of Teachers Oregon. and I'm a board member of the Oregon Education Investment Board. And I'll be brief today. I'd just like to emphasize three main points about Senate Bill 1581. First, AFT Oregon supports Senate Bill 1581 and its inclusive approach to achieving the outcomes we all want in education. AFT Oregon is appreciated working with the governor, the legislature, education advocates, and community stakeholders in addressing the critical issues affecting education at all levels. The educational professionals in our schools, colleges, and universities are concerned with how we set outcomes that guide our education system, particularly in a way that is clear and meaningful to both our profession and the general public. This includes ways to offer support for achieving outcomes and ways to assess those outcomes too. These concerns have been heard by the Oregon Education Investment Board and are reflected in the details of SB 1581. Secondly, I'd like to point out it's critical that we work collaboratively and gain buy-in from educational professionals, from students, from the community, and from civic leaders across the state. If we're going to achieve our goals, we must recognize the value of these voices. We must build on best practices and realize that student achievement is a shared responsibility. Yesterday, we gave your offices a copy of the AFT Oregon Principles of Student Success. This is a document that was assembled with input from our educational professionals across the state. And it highlights our view of the importance of an approach that gets community input and respects the missions of individual institutions and local communities. We need to involve education professionals in the development of the achievement compacts. Top-down models such as No Child Left Behind have not proved fruitful. We certainly don't want to see this repeated again in higher education. You know, I attended four OEIB community forums across the state and heard a lot of people about what matters in education to them. In higher ed, it was success, access, affordability, issues like this. We really need to involve all stakeholders in the process, and I think the amended bill, which you see before you, especially addresses this concern. Finally, I just have to point out, we can't back away from the challenge of funding. You know, our schools, colleges, and universities have never fully recovered from the constitutional property tax caps of the 1990s. You know, state forecast is showing another modest drop. Hopefully we've hit the bottom of the recession now and we're bounding back. But we have to realize, given the lack of stability and adequacy in our revenue system, all of us need to be out in front with the message that economic revitalization goes hand in hand with our strategic investment in education programs at all levels. So AFT Oregon appreciates the governor's linkage to this issue, and our members share his view that investment in education programs is strongly linked to our economic success throughout the state. Thank you.
Thank you.
Could wrap up, Mr. Co-Chair Dembro. You have in the handout, in addition, some sample compacts which have been developed and refined and will be further refined as the board works on this. You can see we started with some long lists of measures, always in these categories of completion, quality, and connections, as well as the equity piece. And they're getting further refined as we go. I think in the most recent subcommittee meeting of the OEIB, we're down to about five measures for K-12. Superintendent Golden told you, these are not to replace other measures which can be quite informative and meaningful of the kind that are captured on the Oregon Report Card. There's another generation of the Oregon Report Card in the works currently, which we think will be adopted by June. But we do want to be focused on the most meaningful, highest level outcomes for achievement when it comes to establishing the compacts and being able to attract achievement of results. That's the case for our community colleges and our universities as well. We, by the way, are gratified that so much work is already being undertaken at the school district level among the community colleges and universities. Work being done on this to further refine the compacts and to learn to inform the discussions with the investment board about what it is to set targets. When the Portland Public Schools came up with their milestones several years ago, they finally reduced them to 4 last year, including high school completion. And district-wide, they saw a 5-point increase in their 4-year cohort high school graduation rate. Evidence, again, that setting targets is key to achieving our goals. We want to note as well that the achievement compacts are a central component of our No Child Left Behind waiver, both as to the accountability mechanism and as to the setting of targets, which is something that is critical to the Federal Department of Education's framework for waivers. And finally, we do expect this to be a process which is iterative. It's a two-way street. We'll be informed not just by what districts tell us, what targets they can set for those high-level measures. We'll also be open to hearing from districts what other measures they think are informative. So there'll be further communications in terms of refining and coming up with the right measures. If we had to pick one measure, it would be the high school completion rate, as I said in my initial comments. But we also want to know if students are on track. We also, to succeed, we want to know that at those key points, which is why, as Nancy pointed out to you, there's a focus on third grade reading and math. The only one of these measures, by the way, that would use OAKS scores. And we want to be looking as well at the progress students are making as they enter high school. Are they on track to succeed? Are they on track to graduate? Are they gaining college credits during their high school years? Those are the kinds of measures that are most meaningful, and those are the kinds that will be the focus. And we think that combined efforts statewide with all of our districts focused on and learning from each other and how we achieve those most meaningful outcomes will provide the transformation you outlined for us in Senate Bill 909.
Thank you very much, Tim. And let me just say that the Higher Ed Committee is joined by several people from other committees. The Education Committee is well represented, and other colleagues are here. Which, as I think about it, that's probably a mistake because I have so many questions to ask, and they're just going to keep me from asking them all. But let me start out with one, and then we have several people have already indicated questions. Tim, I want to follow up on what you're just talking about in terms of the question of how malleable these achievement compacts are. That is, you know, I've heard a couple of different philosophies. You know, at one point we talked about these compacts as being individual compacts and individualizable compacts between the state and individual school districts. Then we heard that districts were going to be given a single template achievement compact for school districts, and then another one for community colleges, another one for universities. And then in conversations that you and I have had, perhaps we're looking at some kind of hybrid there, you know, where there would be a few measures that would be standardized for everyone so that we could have comparability from district to district. We could compare apples to apples, as it were. But then different districts might have different priorities that they say, you know, this is a key to their mission, and they want to be measured according to these. And those are things that would be developed individually by the colleges, universities, or school districts. First of all, is that the case? Is it the case for this first go-around? And how is the timeline going to work for that?
Co-Chair Dembro, what you described as in your last example, your last formulation, is exactly what we have in mind, that the investment board will set a short list of common outcomes so that they are comparable and we can do those apples-to-apples comparisons, always adjusting for differences in student population and be informed by them. And as well, allow districts to tell us if they have other measures that they would like to track and use that fit within this framework of completion, of quality of knowledge and skills, of connections, of a focus on equity and achievement for all of our all groups of students. That will be an iterative process over time. It may be that the board will decide to substitute one measure for another as it's informed by the work and what's working at the district level. But we do think it's important to have a common list so that we can make those comparisons. It will still be up to each district to set targets, guided only by what the investment board will continue to remind districts in every year's achievement compact here's our goal for 2025. Here's the trajectory we think we will need to achieve our high school and college completion goals.
Right.
And please tell us how you think you can make progress to that goal.
Yeah. And so just as a follow-up, so for this first round, you have a target date of March 13th for the OEIB to come up with the sort of, you know, the template part of it. And then how long will districts have to develop their, you know, their own, you know, individual measures and come to agreement with the OEIB over them?
Co-Chair Dembrough, the initial timeline has us distributing the achievement compacts as
the core.
And with the additional optional measure, category for optional measures by April 1, giving districts 3 months as they adopt their budgets in this April, May, June period to both set targets in relation to budgeting a plan, as Superintendent Golden describes it, as well as coming back to us with what additional measures they have in mind. We're still working as to whether we would have a menu of options they may choose from or whether they may simply propose to the board. Our only guidance will be keep it short. I think we what districts that have been most successful have taught us is that that focus on a short and most meaningful list of outcomes is what has been most effective. So we may say, as we're talking about in our subcommittees, districts give us up to 3 additional measures if you think they're meaningful. But again, we want to try and keep this short, and there are many other measures that come into play, many other categories of data that are tracked and reported through the Oregon Report Card, as I mentioned. So it won't be that we're blind to those other accomplishments, but we are definitely wanting to get focused on the most significant outcomes for student success.
Thank you. Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for being here today, and first of all, thanks for telling me when my daughter's going to graduate, because she enters kindergarten next fall, and so 2025 is the year. And just a short comment on the achievement compact is that I haven't seen much parental involvement or comments on parental involvement. And I'm responsible for my daughter's education. And although educators do a lot of assisting me, it's my responsibility. And if I fail at that responsibility, it's my fault. And I expect to be held accountable for educating my daughters. And so I hope that there will always be discussion on how we involve parents and assisting teachers in accomplishing these things. Second thing is on the CEO, and I kind of feel like we're playing musical chairs here. Everybody's just changing chairs, but instead of taking out a chair, we're adding a chair. And it seems to me that there's hardly, when we add this new chair, what teeth does this new position have? How are they going to come in and kick the anthill and get things done? Or are we just adding another layer of bureaucracy? If you could just comment on what executive authority that person will have and how they will wield that authority.
Co-Chair Dembrough, Representative Lindsay, as I described, the direction control authority we request in this legislation is a key to that executive authority, not to build a new team, but to draw on the managerial expertise and the resources in other state agencies, the Department of Education, the Community Colleges and Workforce Development Department, the Chancellor's Office, to convene a team to work on designing and building out that P20 system. We are not supposing that more resources are needed to do that. We are supposing that we need focus. We have nobody in state government currently who is tasked with overseeing that education continuum from early childhood through post-secondary. That is what is unique about this position, and with this position will come the authority to direct other education officials in state government to get focused on building out that P20 system, and we're confident freeing up resources to better support teaching and learning.
Rip Springer,
get both your questions answered.
Sure.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I guess this question is for you, Nancy, and I realize, I'm very aware of what the role of this body is, and I realize what the role is that we've all engaged in this process, but I had opportunity last week. I was able to pop out of the building a little bit early and went down to my son's high school. And frankly, I went in there to pay a bunch of money so he could go run fast around the track and to check on a student that I have legal authority to check on, certainly not a family member. And I checked on that kid because that kid struggles in absolutely every way. And, you know, this particular, his first freshman semester, he earned 1D. And that was it. And so I understand the conversations we've been engaged here, and I have the utmost respect for you, for sure, Nancy, and we've served on different committees through this process, and I understand it. But I walked out of that high school saying, we're doing a lot of important work at the legislature, and we're feeling really good about our plans and our ideas, some of them. And what does that mean to that kid in the classroom? Because if the focus isn't there, and if we're not continuing, and I'm asking you, Nancy, because I think you've probably got the best answer, frankly. If we're having all these conversations and really feeling good about what we're doing, if it doesn't affect his life, what's it about?
Right.
So how does, what changes in the system that a bigger impact can be made there other than one pushy mom that happens to be a state rep who happened to figure out I can legally access his records with parent authority and hands on? How else do we do that?
So Representative Dembro, Representative Springer, if you looked at the evolving compact, what you would see is all of these measures are measures along the pathway, and reading at third grade level, what we know is that if a student exceeds at third grade, they're on a trajectory to graduate successfully. My belief is, and I've seen this in working side by side with students, a lot of the students struggling in high school struggle because by third grade they couldn't read, they couldn't keep up, they were discouraged, they got disconnected, they lost faith in themselves. And so I really believe what these achievement compacts are about, and I think Tim is right, they're very few, but they're key leverage points that says we've got to focus on third grade reading. We've got to make that happen. And of course, what goes with this is the 0 to 20 seamless system, because, you know, part of that is students will come to kindergarten ready to learn. And if they're ready to learn in kindergarten, I believe there's no excuse but for us in K-12 education to have them all reading in third grade. And so I really think you have to start very early. The other point I think is critical in terms of what you're talking about is on track for graduation in ninth grade. We know when students see in ninth grade, I'm credit deficient, they start going, I'm not going to graduate with my peers. So that's what excites me about this. It's a few key measures that we really think do leverage students to be successful along the pathway, and we're going to need to get more focused on a few of these measures, and really because they're key. They're what creates the successful student. But 0 to 5 is critical, and I know you worked on that. So,
thank you, Representative Hunt.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I appreciated Tim's reference to Tiger 12, and I really wasn't familiar, but the beauties of the internet. I looked up, and one of the things that really strikes me about the Tiger 12 and school budget is the piece of the pie that comes from their local option. And that, according to this, is 6% of their budget, so about $7 million for Tiger 12. I know the three school districts I represent, none of them have a local option. And so there is, you know, post-Measure 5, theoretically, equity, but then that starts to fade away. And I don't begrudge Tiger 12 and going for the local option. God bless them. Our local districts have all tried, just not been successful. My biggest concern as I look at all this, and I'm the one person on this panel who will definitely not be up here next year, I'm worried about the next legislative session feeling like they have done everything for education, because we passed 909 and we passed this bill and we passed other legislation, and yet we haven't fundamentally done anything toward what, David, you ended your testimony with, which is the funding, the resources. And I'm not saying resources at all, but resources is clearly a fundamental part of it. And it just as I'm reading through this, as I'm listening to testimony, with the exception of the end of David's comments, it just really feels like there's a lack of the discussion about the adequacy of the resources. So we could get everything right as we're moving around all these chairs, but I walk into my kid's classroom and there are way too many chairs in the classroom. And I'm just trying to figure out how we so integrally connect those two that we can't pass these bills, we can't pass 909, and just say, great, we did it. You know, we know our role, and we did it, and we're walking away, and we still have Measure 5 in place, and we still have the kicker in place, and we still have way too many kids and too many kids in classrooms for too short a year. And I'm just trying to figure out, it's a real fear sitting here, listening and reading this, that it doesn't seem integrally tied in.
Co-Chair Dembro and Representative Hunt, and I think Nancy wants to respond as well, but on behalf of the governor, at every appearance, he is wont to say that he recognizes our education system is underfunded at every level. So that is a key goal. This framework and these proposals we bring you in Senate Bill 1581 are next steps on a pathway to our 2025 goals. They are necessary but not sufficient. But we do believe that the discussion over adequacy of funding will be better informed with all of our districts focused on achieving these most important outcomes. And having this more developed two-way conversation about just how far a district can move the needle on the dial with current levels of funding, how much others can follow them and get their needles on the dial to a similar point, and then how much we can better inform the conversation about the resources we need, whether measured by class size or, I think, even more important outcomes, by student success. I would point out, I don't want to be so negative about our high school graduation rate. Yes, it's only 67%, but about 20% of our students around the state are graduating with college credit, and that's a high watermark. And that's the upside of what we should hopefully be inspired by, and find ways to not just close these gaps, which are so daunting, but motivate student achievement, motivate parental involvement, and all of that's part of the equation.
Thanks, Tim. Let's move to Representative Greenlink. Did you want to follow?
Could I just quickly respond, Representative Hunt? Yeah, I see these. I think the problem is, and I've heard it from a lot of the education community, when they see something, achievement compact and targets, it's really influenced by past conversations, you know, No Child Left Behind. It's top-down targets, they were set out, and I'm really seeing this as just, it's just an open accountability, transparent accountability system, but it's really meant to be a two-way conversation. So we're setting targets. There's been a lot of talk in higher education about the transition from developmental education into academics, or transition of English as a second language students into the regular college courses. There's been a lot of talk about this, and I'm seeing these achievement compacts has the place for that conversation to take place, not a place for some arbitrary top-down targets to be set that nobody feels any relationship to or just sees as not being realistic with the current funding scheme, but really to have an open, honest conversation. And I'm hoping we can encourage that and not be punitive as we have done in past accountability schemes, and really concentrate on that part, the mutual, what can the state offer, what kinds of support can the state offer, and what can we as the education community and the shared responsibility, parents, students, the greater community, bring to this.
Thanks, David. Representative Greenlink.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'd like to follow on. That's a perfect segue. I had a bunch of teachers in my office yesterday, today. I don't remember which day it was, whose hair was pretty much on fire over the question of the achievement compact and the sense of what the old story's been. The feeling that we've had, remember Representative Vakian and I, as far back as it was 2003, said we should give up No Child Left Behind because the stupid tests weren't measuring anything that was real. In the sense that the achievement complex will be based on one more layer of testing, of tests that don't necessarily really relate to what goes on in the classroom. I have a daughter and two son-in-laws who teach in the Portland public school system, and I hear all the time about how their classrooms are turned upside down. Their library, their computer lab is turned upside down over forcing kids to take tests that don't relate to anything real that goes on in the classroom. In the sense that we're leaping off into this faith, and I keep echoing the governor and Tim saying, we have to do something. We have to have a leap of faith. And they're saying that, well, they feel like they're going to be jumping off a cliff rather than having a leap of faith, because the decision matrix won't be something that they relate to as what goes on in the classroom. I wonder, help me with this one, because I had a little trouble in dealing with those with those meetings yesterday, or today, or whichever day it was.
So, Co-Chair Denbro, Representative Greenlick, with the model compact, there's really one measured, standard measure that we're thinking of, which is third grade proficiency, and I think we all do need to know if students are reading at grade level and beyond at third grade. Other than that, all the other measures are things I think we're responsible as administrators. I feel as a superintendent, I have to know if ninth graders are on track towards graduation. That won't require extra work of teachers, and I agree with you. I have utmost respect for teachers and all the demands on them, but that will take working side by side with district offices or ESD, whoever supports it, to really get clear about what does on track for graduation mean and how do we pull data so that we have that information. Our data systems are much more sophisticated than they ever have been, and a lot of times we can pull that. You know, you're looking at grades, you're looking at how many credits. Really, you don't have to ask a teacher to do another thing to get you that data. You can get that data without, but they certainly would probably want to know that data, because all teachers want their students to be on track to graduation. So I think it's the idea here is this is useful information that really helps them move, not, you know, I think the waiver helps us with a lot of the stuff that has troubled us as educators.
Mr. Chair, can I follow up question? Well, my daughter, who's a third grade teacher, is so discouraged that she's getting ready to retire because of the situation, so discouraging, and a former reading specialist, doesn't have any confidence that the third grade reading test really defines what her kids, I mean, she's in basically Title I school with a bunch of different languages. She doesn't think that really tests whether her kids can read or not. And that's the kind of frustration. I mean, she said, no, that's not.
That's why I think these local options, local priorities, I think you could, as a local organization, if you wanted to, you could decide you would use another third grade measure. Again, many of those measures will happen just in your regular district. So if there's other measures that a district believes is more, can also give them that data, you have the opportunity to put that in your local priorities.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tim, I guess I'll address these questions for you as kind of the keeper of the bill, if you will, and so forth. There's some language in Section 14 that wasn't in the original draft that was amended in on the Senate side, and it relates to the discussion about the Quality Education Commission and the report that shall be, I guess, issued along with data on the compacts each year regarding each district's funding as it should compare to QEM and so forth and so on. I guess what I'm asking or wondering about is, it seems that I know the governor's focused on measurable outcomes, and I think that's been the impetus behind the compacts and so forth, trying to get the measurable, quantifiable outcomes. Why would we want to include language that pertains to a hypothetical funding model, which I think QEM is? It's never been implemented fully. It's based on, I think there's some flawed modeling there in terms of what is the ideal school, what is the ideal school situation and so forth. Why we want to put language in there? I guess my concern would be that I think this would lead to a fallback or a bailout, frankly, for either districts or for organizations or entities within a district that perhaps doesn't make the mark, doesn't achieve in the eyes of the OEIB, successful outcomes, allows them to say, we couldn't do it because you didn't give us QEM?
Co-Chair Dembro and Co-Chair Johnson, there are actually two portions of the bill that were added by amendment related to the Quality Education Model and the Quality Education Commission. On the Quality Education Model, I tried to address that in my opening remarks. There are skeptics and believers in the Quality Education Model, and there's work underway now to improve it as well. But I do think that it will be informative to see if there's any correlation between levels of funding as defined by QEM as optimal and the achievement of results. I mentioned to you how Tiger Tualatin, with a student population that looks very much like the statewide population, has been doing much better with a level of spending per student which is right at the mark of the statewide average, which implies that their level of funding under QEM is also at the statewide average, and yet they are achieving above that. We think it will be informative to both the supporters of the QEM and to skeptics of the QEM to kind of look at that. It's just the benchmarking. It's not necessarily going to be up to the district to tell us how relevant they think that is to setting their targets. Further, the second piece added in regard to the Quality Education Commission, a lot of work is being done by that commission beyond the maintenance of the existing quality education model. Commission members have donated their time. These are experienced educators going into schools and looking at their ability to achieve results in math. That was a project they took on over the last couple of years. And a lot of what yet has to follow the implementation of achievement compacts is the ability, when we make those comparisons and look at one district doing better than another, to correctly diagnose what it is that's contributing to success in one district and can be transferable to another. We think that's where the personnel, volunteer personnel on the Quality Education Commission, the staff, and the modeling they do to identify best practices and develop kind of the cost-benefit calculations for what it will cost and what it will benefit us to expand those best practices. It's a resource we don't want to ignore, and that's why we added both those pieces.
Well, I appreciate that response. I guess I'm not convinced. From my perspective, it still looks confusing, and in an outcome-based objective here, I'm not seeing quantifiable numbers here or input here that would really help the process. Another follow-up. There's language beyond that, then, that talks about, as part of the process of entering into an achievement compact, the governing body, I assume that would be the school board, shall ensure that open communication provided to parents, students, teachers, faculty, I agree with all that, employees, and then it specifically says exclusive bargaining representatives. Are you concerned at all about that the details and terms of the compacts at the local levels are going to get swept up in collective bargaining agreements?
Co-Chair Dembro and Co-Chair Johnson, no, we're not. We've had honest discussions about that. The provisions here for collaboration with educators are not bargaining provisions. They are not subject to PECPA or any of the impasse and dispute resolution procedures of the PECPA. They are meant to involve educators and get their best thinking on what can work best in the classroom. And in fact, we think that's what it's going to take to be successful in this endeavor.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Representative Conger.
Thank you,
Welcome.
Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. Members of the committee, thank you for indulging me, and appreciate the opportunity to be here and be part of this conversation. So first, a quick comment, if I may, just following up on something Representative Lindsay started us off with, which has to do with the new chief education officer and that person's ability to direct and control the subsidiary positions that are listed in the bill now. And I heard in, I think, Tim's testimony that there won't be any hiring or firing going on. This is a comment, and I'm sure it will invite a response, but I'm going to move on to my question. But I do want to say it makes it hard to understand how that person could have any direction or control over someone whose fate they have no direction or control over. Moving on to my question. I want to continue the line of questioning about achievement compacts. So to me, ideally what we're looking for here is information. So we're trying to collect meaningful information that will possibly enhance accountability, but also maybe enhance our understanding of what best practices are in terms of teaching and administration. And so we have this plan in the form of an achievement compact that we're aspiring to. And then we have, beyond the plan, execution. Now, when I look at somebody like Nancy, I know that she will execute. I have absolute confidence that that will happen. Mm-hmm. However, we're not really doing this for the benefit of, we're doing it for the non-performers, I think. And the key ingredient here, I believe, between the teachers who are actually on the ground doing the work and the planning sort of at the state level that we're looking at, is the administration. And so if we're trying to modify behavior by administrations, how are we going to hold them accountable if they fail?
Okay. Co-Chair Denbro, Representative Conger, good question. I like that question. So what I want to say first is I do want you to know there's a committee between OEA, OSBA, and COSA, who's beginning to work as professional organizations about what are the roles we can play to really support moving forward on the achievement compact. So all of our professional, because I think you have to sort of rethink all our organizations. So I know as a member of COSA, it's really important that we have a very strong administrative evaluation system. We have one in place in Springfield, and then it's my job to work through the directors of instruction to make sure that we hold people accountable to them. So, you know, there has been some other legislation that has passed that has really supported us, like the 290 bill. It was a Senate Bill 290 that really looked at evaluation of teachers and administrators, and we need to have those in place. And then, you know, ultimately, I say it's the superintendent's responsibility to make that happen. But I also do want you to know, as professional organizations, we're committed to this, and we really want to shift how we think together about this. I mean, we had an initial meeting with our three organizations, and it was very powerful about how we're all going to support school board members and administrators and teachers to really make sure we meet the outcomes we can and to be supportive of each other along the way. So I think it's a whole system. It's about the supports, it's about the evaluation, and it's about the accountability to the compacts and ultimately to the children. I have to go back to that kindergarten class. There's nothing more exciting than to go to a kindergarten orientation because every possibility in the world sits in that orientation. So I invite you all to our first kindergarten orientation. You'll love it.
Thank you, Nancy.
May I follow up that?
Quickly, please.
I'll rephrase it. So under the achievement compacts, what are the consequences if the school district fails to meet the agreed to metrics? When I think compact, I think contract. And so there's an agreement by the two sides. The nature of my question was, what are the consequences of failure?
And Coach Denbro and Representative Conger, we also showed you how this is one system to guide the state's investment decisions and to inform us as to how districts are achieving on common set of measurable outcomes. In addition to that, there are the provisions in place in the No Child Left Behind, the waiver that we've proposed, which will identify the lowest performing schools as priority or focus schools. I may have that reversed, focus and priority schools, where all the interventions that were in the No Child Left Behind toolbox remain, but where we hope to be a lot more focused on particularly what works in a district before those interventions are applied. But they are all there, and they will be done as part of the process of the No Child Left Behind waiver. The limitations of the No Child Left Behind system as it evolved, I mentioned the example of Tiger Tualatin. A majority of their 17 schools will probably be in that category of what's colloquially known as failing under No Child Left Behind. And it's not that that's a stigma. We can look beyond that because we know what they're achieving. It's that they would then, under the current No Child Left Behind system, have to resort to certain interventions that are prescriptive and wouldn't have any leeway to kind of stay the course with what's working. there are other examples of that around the state. So it'll be a more flexible range of interventions, but they will still be there, and they will be applied at the school level.
Okay, let's move on to Rep. Wingard, and then Rep. Harker, and then I think we'll have to move on to our next panel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Tim, I appreciate Representative Conger's question. It was going to be one of my own, and I think we're still avoiding an answer to that question. I don't think he really got one, and I don't think that the legislature has really received an answer from the governor's office on what the thinking is about exactly how we will hold people accountable for the contracts or compacts that we're asking them to sign. Because otherwise, we're just going out and telling the public we've got another bold plan for raising achievement, and we've done this before, and it hasn't necessarily, no one's really held accountable when it doesn't happen. But I want to move on to a second question, which is, you know, the whole concept in the bill is this idea that we're going to kind of up the stakes on the districts, and we're going to, this time we really mean it. We're going to hold you accountable for raising achievement scores. But I look in the bill, and I'm trying to figure out what changes in the system. You know, what do we put in the bill that gives districts more control over their budgets or more leeway that empowers the people trying to implement this compact we're going to make them sign? What in the bill gives them more flexibility over this very highly bureaucratic system right now so that they might have a fighting chance of getting to some of these achievement goals that we're going to ask them to promise to get to?
Co-Chair Dembro and Representative Wingard, I think it's quite significant that with passage of this bill, all 197 school districts, their governing boards, will be adopting budgets for the next school year that are focused on certain outcomes that we all consider to be the most critical. I think that's an important and significant next step. As to whether they achieve them, that will be in itself a informative part of this process in what will be a two-way street between the state and local districts to determine why, if there's underachievement, it's occurring. A district could also achieve its target and still be found to be underachieving versus comparable districts. So we're going to have to be focused on what we learn from the setting of targets, which, by the way, has proven to be very effective in districts which have done that. Ben Lapine is one example. Portland, with its recently established milestones, is another. The Cradle Career milestones adopted by all the school districts in Multnomah County are also informed by this experience. We're trying to learn from what's worked, and I think the process we're putting in place will continue to will create a continuous improvement model between the state and local districts, beginning with budgeting for outcomes, which was the guidance we got in Senate Bill 909, and we think it's an important part of this framework we're putting in place.
Just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. I still think that what is missing in here is that there are no tools in the bill for districts to be able to change this, you know, what they're doing now. I mean, a lot of districts are really locked in, and they have very little control over their budgets. So it's just difficult for me to imagine how they can meet the goals we're going to ask them to meet if it's not accompanied with any flexibility to allow them to do the kind of innovating that's being suggested here.
And again, Co-Chair Dembro and Representative Wingard, we're talking here about one part of the state's system for establishing a coordinated system from early childhood through post-secondary. One part of that is investment. Another part of that, and this is all going to be part of the thinking that informs the process of designing and organizing this P20 system. One part is investment. Another part has to do with direction and coordination, as when the Board of Education sets the Common Core standards and works with districts to align efforts to achieve them. And the third part is support. And that is the part which I think has waned over the years because of budget cuts and other mandates from the feds, our Department of Education has become a lot more focused on compliance and a lot less able to provide support. We hear over and over again from superintendents, and I'll see if Nancy wants to add anything here, that that's an element that they think is critical, one that they miss in our system. And we have to back up and say, what if we're going to create this more effective and coordinated system, it's going to have to start at the state level. We're the ones who can oversee all the efforts in the district, and it's going to have to be focused on investment, on direction coordination, and on support. And all of that will be part of this effort that is led by the Chief Education Officer, and we don't think this direction and control authority we've asked for, to respond again to Representative Conger's question, is the end-all and the be-all. This is this year's project, and we expect to bring you the next best steps next year, as well as the ones we're putting in place this year. It doesn't end with this bill.
Okay, thank you. Rep. Harker, last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in the interest of time, I'll just make an observation, and you can address it if you like. Obviously, there's great interest in this. The people are watching like mad, and they're certainly speaking to you. They're speaking to us loudly. I have heard from many constituents that there is a concern that the costs of these changes, of the testing and reporting associated with the changes, though noble, the costs are going to be very high, and that we're going to take additional resources out of the classroom where we're already strapped and not nearly funding at the QEM level, as has already been related. So I would just urge everyone involved to be very cost conscious as we're going forward, and to leave as many of the very limited resources that we have in the classrooms as much as possible.
Thank you, Representative Harker. Thanks to all three of you. As you could tell from the questions that were elicited, there's a lot of interest in the issues around this bill. Thank you very much for your work on it. So let's call up our second panel now, please, and that's Anna Vandering and Jim Saul. I'm sorry. Betsy Miller Jones. I'm sorry, Betsy. Okay. Hannah, do you want to start? You're OEIB member, and tell us if we missed anything in our previous panel.
Yes, thank you. Co-chairs Denbrough and Johnson, my name is Johanna Vandering. I'm an elementary physical education teacher, vice president of the Oregon Education Association, and a member of the OEIB board. And I'd like to just share a little information from OEA and the members that we represent across the state. We embrace the goals of a seamless P-20 system. And we think that working together, we can create a process that will make a difference in the lives of our students. You've heard the main objectives of this bill. I want to just share a couple of highlights. Hiring the chief education officer. Educators believe strongly that this individual needs to have experience in public education. They need to be a collaborator, and they need to be someone that can bring us all together. All of the adults need to be working together to make a difference in the lives of the students that we serve. The second area is the compacts. You've had lots of discussion about the compacts. Oregon educators, we welcome accountability. We welcome the opportunity to create a document such as the compact that will truly impact student achievement. But that will take a lot more work from where we are right now. You have my written testimony, and I'll just highlight the eight bullets that we have here. Achievement compacts need to be created collaboratively. If educators and parents and our administrators are not working together, these compacts we won't commit to them, and they won't make a difference for those students that solely need us to work together. We need to make sure that we understand there's a difference between pre-K and K-12, community college, and higher ed. The compacts need to reach those students in those areas that we are working to make sure that seamless system really creates. We need to have access to data, the data that really matters to educators, not the data from those test scores that some like us to focus on, but data that really makes a difference so that our students can succeed in their lives. the overemphasizing that we've done on standardized tests over the last decade has truly negatively impacted our students, and we need to get away from that. We need to align our investments in our schools so we get to the outcomes that will make a difference. Protect local control, making sure that those parents and educators are really working towards what will make a difference in the lives of the students in their area, and address the needs of the whole child and reach each one of those students where they are. We are the hungriest state in the nation. There are poverty issues. If we want to get towards prosperity, we have to address that issue. And then we need to have shared accountability. It's not about educators being held accountable. It is, I loved Representative Lindsay's comment about parents being responsible for their students or their child's education. And we believe that working together with parents, educators can make a difference, but it also will take all of you helping us get there. I am a member of the OEIB, and I did attend all seven of the community forums, and I did participate in the town hall that we had. The passion for public education in this state is there. We had educators, parents, students, business community leaders, and other activists show up at those passions, at those meetings, and I want to share just a few of the highlights. The likes that they shared with us, the main likes with the Oregon Learns document, was our focus on early learning, the coordination of PK through 20, an alternative to No Child Left Behind, and the respect for local control that they saw in that document. The concerns, the number one concern that Oregonians have is funding. They are concerned that we are not prepared to move this forward efficiently. Testing is another concern. Addressing the needs of the whole child, making sure that we're looking at every aspect of that child's learning, not just literacy and math, is something we heard strongly. The role of the parents was shared, and they need to be involved in this, and also the issue of poverty that we have to address in this state. The strengths of their local community education systems that they shared, the first one was caring, dedicated educators that work with the students in their schools. The second was their community commitment to education. And thirdly, a look at collaboration and innovation to create something that will really make a difference. The challenges for their local education community were funding, poverty, class size that I think Representative Hunt mentioned, too many students in a classroom, and the overemphasizing testing in our schools. OEA supports this bill, but we believe we need to work together to make sure that we go at a rate and pace that we can truly implement something that matters. So as we roll out the first compacts this year, if we're going to do that, we need to make sure we do it together with the educators and the parents in the community and talk about what matters. This needs to be a baseline data that we're collecting, and it needs to help us understand what our goal is. If our end goal is to make sure that we're creating something that will truly impact student achievement, then we have to talk about the things that matter. We have to embed in those compacts things that will truly help our students be successful. So we look forward to working with you and the governor to create those documents. We look forward to having educators be at the table with our administrators and parents so that they create something that matters for our students. Lastly, you know, reforms have come and gone in this state. And I remember when I was first starting in education, and Sim and Cam and my colleagues all told me, just don't worry about it. It will go away, and we won't be held accountable for this. And it wasn't that they didn't want to be held accountable, but they wanted something that mattered, and they were not committed to that. If we want to make a difference here in Oregon, then we need to work together to create something that we can all commit to and that we all buy into, and that we're willing to do the hard work to come up with the funding that it will take to truly change public education in Oregon. So I hope that we can do that. I do want to mention the question about accountability in the teeth of the compacts. Just want to mention that I don't know any educator that walks into their school in the morning, gets on their bus in the morning, that doesn't want to make a difference in the lives of the students that they work with. And for us to say that what we want to do through these compacts is to create a process in which we get away from No Child Left Behind, which told us not only what we were to accomplish, but how we were to accomplish it, but to move towards something where you tell us what you want to accomplish, and then you allow those professionals that you've hired, the best and the brightest teachers that you can hire in this state, allow them to use their professional discretion, their creativity, to build a program that really makes a difference so that those students can learn. So I hope that we can do that together, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you, Hannah. Why don't we move on to Jim? Jim, I know you have to get down to do whatever it is you do at Lane Community College. So,
yeah, thank you, Co-Chairs Dembrough and Johnson. I do have a class at 6 o'clock tonight in Eugene, so I'm going to I'll try and stay as long as I can and then and run. Please don't take any offense. My name is James Salt. I'm a sociology faculty member at Lane Community College. And I'm here primarily to talk about the role of achievement compacts in community colleges, which a little bit surprisingly we've heard very little of today, despite the central role that community colleges will play in this vision. My remarks today reflect my roles, in three different roles. One, as president of the faculty union at Lane Community College, and as president of the Oregon Education Association Community College Council that represents thousands of educational faculty and staff across the state. Also as a member of the LCC administration faculty staff team that's been working on achievement compacts, and also as a sociologist that studied education relationship between education and society for the last 25 years. I have three points I'd like to make tonight. I have a number of other concerns, but I, in the interest of time, I've focused on just these three. The first is primarily a concern as a sociologist and as someone who's watched educational reform movements come and go across Oregon and across the country for the several last decades. And I'm very concerned that we're going down a road that while we make tremendous commitments to educational growth and achievement, and those commitments are excellent and supported, of course, by all educational professionals, there's really little or no analysis as to why we are where we are now, nor a real strategy for how to get to is to where we want to go. Instead, what we have is an aspirational commitment that then we're going to be held accountable to. And that's setting us up, I think, as a recipe for failure and frustration. I went to two high schools. One was Acton Boxborough Regional High School outside Boston. The other one was Bangor High School in Maine. Acton had 100% of its students graduate high school. 85% went to college. Bangor had 25% of my class drop out as sophomores, right, at ages 14 and 15. Right. The problem wasn't the teachers in Bangor, the problem wasn't the schools, it wasn't even that much of a lack of a commitment to education. I don't think anybody here thinks that Bangor can become Acton simply by saying we're going to, simply by setting some goals and saying we're going to do it in pieces, by this time we're going to get there, and you know whether we have accountability connected to that or not. That isn't how you promote educational achievement. I personally believe that we shouldn't be setting specific targets. I think that what we should be doing is coming together as a state and doing the analysis to figure out why Bangor isn't in Acton. Why are we not at the 40-40-20 we want to be at? What would it take to get there? And coming up with a real plan, not simply some aspirational goals that have some accountability measures connected to them. Just do it or else is not a real strategy or a real plan. It is what's in front of us, I believe. Secondly, as I'm sure you know, there are a variety of measures that the various educational institutions are expected to collect, and they're in the process of being created now. One of the measures, the categories, is the measure of quality. I don't know what the thinking behind that is. I would surmise that the reason to include that is that we want to not substitute quantity for quality. If so, great. But how do we then do that? How do we ensure that we're not substituting quality for quantity for quality? Having a handful of measures created by a committee or created by the local institutions or some combination of the two is not a mechanism, at least for higher education, do I think I can speak to, for doing that. we have a system for ensuring the quality of education and higher education. This committee is well familiar with that. It's the accreditation process. It's a very rigorous process. We have 114 criteria that we use to assess our institutions, plus a long list of policies, plus a set of standards, a rigorous process that involves members of the faculty, the administration, staff at these schools, site visits, peer review, et cetera, et cetera. We have a good system. We don't need a government committee coming in and telling us, focus on these three things or five things or 50 things. If that's the approach we're going to go, we're going to end up uniting the right, the left, and the center, politically speaking, in opposition to this, because it's not going to accomplish anything other than that opposition. Finally, I have concerns about the process. I think we're going far too fast, and without the involvement of all of the sectors that we need. We have very little participation at this point of actual educators in the process. We have timelines. We're told March 13th we're going to have these compacts established that everyone is then going to have to operate with. The bill hasn't even passed yet. In 3 weeks from now, approximately, these are going to be set in stone, and all the educational institutions across the state are going to be expected to commit all of our time and energy on these. This is not a real plan. I'll say it again. Just do it or else is not a real plan. Let's have a real plan that we can commit to. We're not afraid of the goals. What we need is a way to get there. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Betsy, before I turn to you, I just want to say, so I'm a realist, and this House Bill 1581, Senate Bill 1581 has obviously generated a lot of interest. And we do have several people who've signed up to speak to it. And so I've asked the indulgence of our guests who are here to speak to the other bill, Senate Bill 1538, if they'd be willing to come back on Thursday to talk to us about that. They are, and that's what we'll do. So we'll spend the remainder of this hearing on this this bill, 1581.
You may just want to clarify which one 1538 is for folks who are here for a third issue.
Oh, yes, and I did want to clarify that. Members, you received an error, some testimony that really does not apply to this hearing at all. It's for the session that follows this hearing. But the person who was delivering it was going to appear at both, but had to leave. And so that's why I just wanted to clarify that. This is not part of the record of this hearing. Okay. All right, Betsy, would you please introduce yourself? And
thank you, co-chairs and members. I'm Betsy Miller-Jones. I'm the interim executive director of the Oregon School Boards Association. I'm also a former school board member. The top priority for our locally elected and volunteer school board directors, and thus OSBA, is supporting ways to improve student achievement and success. The achievement compacts proposed in Senate Bill 1581 represent an opportunity to us to build greater collaboration in school districts around shared goals and better outcomes for students. The Board of Directors of the Oregon School Boards Association voted unanimously to support the concept of achievement compacts because our members want to help develop a homegrown system of improving student achievement and accountability, one that's collaborative with our community and our teachers and designed at the local level. Our current one-size-fits-all system under No Child Left Behind contains prescriptive sanctions and does not meet the needs of schools or students in Oregon. So when you ask me in short why we support this, it's because it gets us out from under those prescriptive sanctions and that higher federal control and brings it more locally. Our members support the efforts of Governor Kitzhaber and Superintendent Castillo to seek a waiver from No Child Left Behind. The concept of achievement compacts is a key component of Oregon's waiver request. Oregon OSBA believes that achievement compacts reflect the types of systems more closely that school board members and educators have been looking for since the unintended consequences and faults of No Child Left Behind first became apparent. The punitive one-size-fits-all system of interventions and oversight of NCLB have not served Oregon schools and most importantly, Oregon's students well. We have an opportunity here to tailor outcomes to the unique circumstances of individual school districts. Our 197 school districts and 19 education service districts have very different student populations and community challenges. What may work in Beaverton might not be right for Burns. We must empower our local school boards to make the changes and meet those local challenges. We see achievement compacts as a way to share best practices and still give boards the flexibility to make the compacts fit the needs of their students. School board members look forward to working collaboratively with superintendents, administrators, teachers, parents, other education stakeholders to make sure that achievement compacts work for our students at the local level. Increasing student achievement is a cornerstone of the work of school boards. OSBA's support of achievement compacts reflects the unwavering commitment of school boards to find solutions that are research-based, locally designed, and meet the needs of our communities. To be successful, ultimately, in the long run, these compacts must be accompanied by state-level resources, additional mandate relief, and relief from the No Child Left Behind Act. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Betsy. Colleagues, questions of this panel? Yes. Okay. Our guest, Representative
Penny
Geyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I join Representative Conger as a guest here from the Health Committee, and so I'm very interested in how the education transformation and the health transformations can ultimately come together. I am in favor of this legislation mostly because of the reasons that many of you have already outlined in terms of bringing back, having a framework for a local discussion and local control with parents and teachers and faculty and policymakers around what are the kinds of things you want to be held accountable for. And I know there's a big tension between tight loose, but I'm also a little concerned, and I guess I just want to get it on the record and hear any kind of reaction to the idea of tying it just to the reading and math, because while there is a lot of evidence out there that talks about how kids are going to do, whether or not they're ready to learn when they enter kindergarten, third grade reading levels, how they're doing in ninth grade, there's also a lot of evidence that shows the connection, the direct correlation between physical, emotional, and emotional health and educational outcomes. And so, you know, you have said that we want to collect data and hold ourselves accountable to where we want to put our investments and where evidence shows that it really makes a difference. And so I think about a lot of the research that's come out with the kindergarten and first grade and second graders who are missing a lot of school and how that gets us off track for the third grade reading levels. If all we're measuring is third grade reading levels, and we put a lot of emphasis into SMART programs and other kinds of interventions that work with the schools, but miss some of those other whole child, whole family that, Hannah, you mentioned, I'm concerned about that. So I recognize there's the tension between, you know, not wanting to put too many things into the compacts, and yet also wanting to make sure that this generation that's graduating at lower rates than the last generation and is also unhealthier and is setting our society up for, you know, large rates of obesity and other kinds of things that drain school resources, just as high school dropout lowers state resources, that we need to have those conversations together. So I just offer that as, you know, maybe you stick to just a few little things that you're going to measure, but ultimately I hope that as you develop the capacity in the state to help districts look at the other kind of inputs that lead to those outcomes, that will be front and center.
Co-chairs, Representative, thank you for that comment. And I would say if the OAIB does not look closely at how we create a process to educate the whole child, we did not listen to Oregonians in the forums that we just held. We have not listened to the community members and the parents who are crying out for us to get away from the testing craziness and towards what really matters for our students. Because there's brain research out there, there's all kinds of research that shows that it's not just reading and math that makes a difference in the lives of a student. If they're not healthy, if they don't feel safe in their schools, they're not going to be successful. And that's something that this board has to take very seriously and find a way to create this path to find the whole child back in our schools, because that's what our community wants, and that is certainly what educators across the state want.
Thank you.
Okay, Rep. Johnson, and then we'll call up our first public
speaker. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Betsy, I just want to thank you, first of all, for your job of stepping into the fray there at OSBA. I know you came on board in some difficult circumstances, but I think you're doing a great job, so thank you for your leadership. I also want to thank you for, or thank OSBA for actually testifying last week in a committee in this building and on behalf of an agricultural natural resource development bill. Because if we talk about money, we talk about funding, we talk about general funds available for, you know, health care, education, everything. We've got to, I think, help from our public agencies in advocating on behalf of sound economic job-producing policy bills, too. And I want to thank OSBA for taking the lead on that. But I wanted to get back to a question that I think Representative Conger had earlier, or perhaps it was Representative Wingert, but again, about those tools. You know, the thing that gets overlooked in this whole discussion, when you talk about hypothetical, you know, education performance and so forth, is that it all, the rubber meets the road at that school district, school board level. It's, you know, I've got my school board hat on here, too. I'm still serving on a board in my district. But, you know, I think you would agree that we can't overlook the fact that at the local level, boards need to be empowered to have as much positive influence as possible at the local level. And i.e., I'm talking about being able to ensure that we have the tools available that our educators, and I'm talking about teachers, I'm talking about administrators well, are the best, the brightest, the best equipped they can be able to interact in those classrooms with those kids in a positive fashion. And that I would just, again, advocate that we need sooner rather than later, and I think by a date semi-certain, that we can ensure that we have a policy here in this state, a system that allows us to ensure that we do have regular evaluations for teachers, regular evaluations for administrators, to ensure that they are the best that they can be so that we can help them excel, so we can ensure that we've got our best contacts with our kids at that level. And I just be interested to have any comments or thoughts you might have about that topic.
We have been working with OSBA, OEA, and COSA together, and the topic of conversation are the supports and tools to provide to all of our members to make this successful. So I think I agree with the essence of what you've said here, and it is a concern and a focus of ours going forward. Again, while not perfect, I don't think anything is first time out of the box, this does provide relief to districts from those punitive No Child Left Behind federal mandates. It also allows us some relief in areas of Division 22 reporting. Mm-hmm. So there's some very good things. It's a good direction. There's still work to do, and we look forward to working with our partners in making this successful and providing those resources and tools for local boards and championing that going forward.
Thank you very much for this, for the excellent testimony, all three of you. Thank you. Really appreciate it. Okay, I'm going to call up Chris Allman, Margaret DeLacy, and Carolyn, I'm sorry, Marnach? Marnach? Carolyn, if you're here. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, while they're coming up, can I just comment in response to Representative Johnson's statement?
Yes.
I mean, sure. I think it's time we relook at Measure 5 and Measure 50, because I think they produce a situation that basically takes away the power from the local boards, both to fund schools the way they want to be funded and to manage schools. I mean, we end up with a 91-member school board in Salem, and it's not all that useful.
Thank you, Representative. Okay, so in the order in which you signed up, we have Chris, Margaret, and Carolyn. Chris, you want to start? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Co-Chairs Dembro and Johnson and members of the House Committee on Higher Education. I appreciate the opportunity to give this testimony today. I'm a parent with a 17-year-old in public high school. I'm also a grassroots activist with Oregon Save Our Schools, a new statewide coalition of parents, teachers, and community members.
Chris, I'm sorry, can I interrupt you? Could you identify yourself for the record, please?
Sorry.
Thank you.
Chris Allman, sorry. So we're a new statewide coalition of parents, teachers, and community members who are committed to keeping the public in public schools. Oregon Save Our School says no on Senate Bill 1581. An education CEO, an education investment board, is accountable to a governor, and it's simply not democratic. Achievement compacts will do nothing to create the kind of conditions for equitable access to quality education that we want, and by we, I mean every community and parent in a local school. In fact, we have a treasurer at University of Oregon, Yang Zhao. He's presidential chair and assistant dean for global education there. He's got a blog on ditch testing, and he mentions that there are societal, opportunity, educational, and financial costs, and I'm going to really focus on the financial costs. We'd like to see the legislators submit a budget note while Senate Bill 1581 is in Ways and Means. The lost decade of No Child Left Behind has trickled down unfunded mandates from the federal to local level. In April 2011, the Legislative Fiscal Office asked Assistant Superintendent Doug Costi about the cost savings from decreased testing. The cost of assessments at the state level is currently about $30 million per biennium, with the federal government kicking about a third of all funds at the local level. No idea. So we heard Tim Nesbitt talk about cost benefits. If there are any benefits from current and future reforms, Oregon needs to account for those actual costs. We do understand the threat. We understand how there are up to 250 Title I schools that receive federal funding and are expected to fail this next year. But this threat should not become the opportunity to create sweeping changes that do not empower the parent and local schools to do what is best for their child. The waiver was due today, but it was submitted nearly a month ago before the legislature could debate the statutory provisions that are necessary to implement the waiver. The state of California is wavering on the waiver. Why? Because it estimates it could cost Californians as much as $3 billion to meet conditions set by the Obama administration. Oregon's waiver relies on K-12 achievement compacts to replace NCLB's system of measures and sanctions. And we're sure that achievement compacts will get away from this arbitrary and ineffective mandates of NCLB, and we'll have this individual student growth and learning. But on Friday, I went to a subcommittee meeting of the Oregon Education Investment Board, and there Brian Reyna from the National Governors Association gave a presentation. He said that Oregon's achievement compacts should include only, quote, meaningful, objective, quote, research-based measures that are limited and actionable. And we've heard about just one third grade test. Well, I've also gone to presentations on the Smarter Balance Assessment Consortium, and they're talking about 5 interim tests a year. So I'm not hearing less testing.
Chris, if I could interrupt, we have to move along. And you've submitted your testimony in writing. So could you just kind of wrap up?
Okay.
Thank you very much.
All right. I understand. Well, essentially, we are very worried about all the costs. We'd like to see some language in Ways and Means to address what's happening at the local level. Inputs do matter. You can't have accountability with accounting for those costs. And we want to slow down too and vote. Ask for you to vote no on Senate Bill 1581. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Margaret?
Good afternoon, Representative Dembro, Representative Johnson, and members of the committee. I want to thank you very much for having this hearing. I believe that this bill hasn't had adequate process yet and maybe isn't quite ready. I did bring testimony. Before I get started, I'd like to say one thing that has really disappointed me about the achievement compacts, which is that they don't seem to include any measure for growth, and without looking at student growth, I think we're going to continue to be punishing districts for their demographics instead of looking at whether they're doing a good job for students. That's really a critical way to look at student performance, and it's just disappeared from the compact process. I'm really here to answer questions because you do have my testimony. I often seem to be here defending the unmentionable. Today, I'm here to talk about those Division 22 standards. They are not an integral part of the bill, but I did hear Ms. Vandering say that if children aren't safe and healthy in our schools, they won't be successful. The Division 22 compliance reports are the way that we make sure our children are safe and healthy in schools. And OTAG, the Oregon Association for Talented and Gifted, does not believe that suspending compliance reports for safety and health in schools, including child abuse reporting, asbestos standards, emergency plans, and student health, is the way to get to better schooling. So I'd like to use the rest of my time to answer any questions you may have. I've included a list of the affected standards in my testimony and also an example of the very burdensome paperwork that districts are being asked to dispense with. It is, in fact, one page. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Margaret. Questions for Margaret? I'll just ask one clarifying question. So under the bill, the Division 22 requirements are themselves not suspended. It's just the reporting on them that is. But your concern is that by not reporting on them, people who monitor the process won't know if a district is complying or not. Is that your point?
Chair Denbrough and Representative Johnson, yes. I've consulted with a number of groups that represent students who are affected by these standards, and there seems to be considerable agreement that if school districts are no longer reporting to the public, which is a piece of it, or to the State Department of Education, that they are meeting these standards, it sends a signal to them that student health and safety is a lower priority, and it also makes it virtually impossible for communities to follow the status of these standards in their schools.
Thank you. Okay, Carolyn, please.
Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Denbrough and Johnson and members of the committee. My name is Caroline Marnock. I'm a member of Stanford Children and a parent of two boys in our public high schools who are both now driving. But I'm here today to offer our support of Senate Bill 1581. It is the next important step towards erasing Oregon's steady decline in the education that we're providing our children. We are all fully aware of the need to improve our schools. But my worry now is that our leaders have become numbed to this. It's a little like hearing the blaring horn of a train. At first, it jolts us from shock of hearing that horn blasting, but over time, we become accustomed to it, and we sleep through it. And my hope is that you do not become deaf to our constant and admittedly desperate pleas, and rouse yourselves to take action now. And I think this is one small step towards doing us to get us out of the onerous burdens of the No Child Left Behind Act that Representative Kenny Geyer talked about. Because the status quo is just not acceptable. We're going to be still hamstrung by all those testing requirements, and this is one way towards getting out of that. The achievement compacts created by this bill are a way to improve our student achievement. First, the compacts are essential to obtain a waiver. And while the Act itself, the No Child Left Behind Act, it's raised awareness about Oregon's shortcomings in our reading and math proficiency, our low graduation rates, and our starking achievement gap. So that is a true benefit of it. But it didn't give us those tools to solve the problems. And in fact, what they've done, their punitive sanctions, haven't improved our student performance at all. So we now have an opportunity to get out of that. So we need to do these achievement compacts. One of the other things, I think it was Representative Lindsay, I heard him testify in the other room about how parents can get involved. What, you know, there was nothing in the bill. And it struck me because the one thing that I know is going to happen is that districts are finally going to have to be public and talk about their goals and announce it in a much more broad state way. That alone, I think, in sharing those results is going to be a key factor to getting parents involved and earning the trust of the community. The representative talked about the fiscal needs and how I think he mentioned how they can't get levies passed. Well, if you can get the trust of the community by publicizing what our goals are, what we're doing, how we're getting our graduation rate up, you're going to get people's votes to support this and make changes. And they're going to pass the levies because they're going to see, oh, look, our school board is actually doing something instead of meeting behind closed doors. I think this is a really positive step in the right direction. And maybe, hopefully, we'll get some really broad, bold fiscal changes that if we can get this step done, maybe next year we can finally fund our schools. So it is time for Oregon to join our other states that have sought and obtained waivers
from the No Child Left Behind Act. The status quo is just not acceptable. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Caroline. Okay, thank you, all three of you. Okay, we have one last panel, and it is a stellar one. It includes Duncan Wise and Randy Choi, please. I think that's it. Is Ruth Murray here, Phil? Ruth, you signed up to speak for this bill or for the other bill?
For 1581.
Oh, okay. Why don't you come on up, too, please? Let's make this panel.
I'm really great.
Let's make this even better.
You've got 2 minutes, right?
Take all you want.
You go first, man.
Okay.
Thank you, Randy.
There are high expectations right now. Oh, my goodness. Thank you for the opportunity. Co-chairs Dembro and Johnson, members of the committee. My name is Randy Choi, and I'm the program officer for education and special funds at the Oregon Community Foundation, Oregon's largest foundation. The foundation's board of directors voted unanimously and enthusiastically on February 8th to endorse Senate Bill 1581. I've submitted my testimony along with a letter from our president and board chair that was sent earlier to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. OCF doesn't take positions on public policy very often, only when the stakes are highest and when our voice can make the most difference. And I apologize for getting over a cold, so my voice isn't the strongest today. But this is one of those times where we want to make sure our voice is heard. I've worked in the education field for 20 years, and I've never seen Oregon so ready to take the bold steps needed to help our state be more strategic and more accountable in its use of education resources. And we believe these new directions have the potential to lead us towards significant improvements in education outcomes. OCF invests about $10 million annually throughout the 0 to 20 education continuum in areas that have the greatest impact. This bill is important to Oregon for many reasons that align with OCF's own investments in education, which is the foundation's highest priority. We know that some of the details within the bill regarding the achievement compacts and the responsibilities of the chief education officer need clarification. We know that some of this is a leap of faith. However, Oregon is falling way short in preparing its young people to lead productive lives and contribute to their communities. And we can't stand for that any longer. We know that getting to 40-40-20 will be very difficult, but we need transformational change now, and this bill continues the positive momentum that was generated out of the last session. We need bold action. We need bold leadership. The Oregon Community Foundation urges your support of Senate Bill 1581. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Randy. Duncan.
Thank you. Chair Dembro and Chair Johnson, my name is Duncan Wise. I'm president of the Oregon Business Council, and I'm testifying on behalf of the council today. I'm also on the Board of Education and the Quality Education Commission. And in 2 minutes, I'm going to summarize very briefly. I think this is a very important bill, and I encourage you to pass Senate Bill 1581. Context here, I think you should be really proud of yourselves as a legislature. What you did last session propelled all the work you've heard today. And I know there are a lot of questions. I know there are a lot of concerns. You've talked a lot about them. But let's think about what's just happened. You have a conversation about what it is going to take to dramatically improve student achievement in Oregon. You're asking a group of educators throughout the state have engaged in a very intense dialogue over the last 6 months to bring you this bill, which are, as Tim Nesbitt said, two important next steps to on a much longer journey of building an outcome-based education system. I think the kinds of questions you are raising really are the kinds of questions I hope you'll continue to ask as this whole process unfolds. Start with the outcomes. You're going to see those outcomes in the achievement compacts. You're going to see measures of those outcomes in the achievement compacts. And you're going to have a lot of questions about how individual schools are doing against those measures as you come into the next legislative session. Think about how much more powerful that information is going to be than what you traditionally see in a Ways and Means Committee, Representative Springer and Dembro, as opposed to the kind of conversations you normally have. I think it sets up the kind of two-way conversation with the field that we need to have if we're really going to figure out what the strategies are for achieving the 40-40-20 goal. So it's an important next step of setting outcomes and beginning the dialogue at the school level about what it's going to take to get to 40-40-20. The second piece related to the chief education officer is also, I think, really important. The chief education officer is going to have a very big assignment when he or she takes that job of designing the state-level resources in a way that supports great teaching and learning on the ground. And by giving that individual the authority to, for example, design a set of pathways to degrees, something Representative Frederick and I worked on a lot on the Board of Education. But how do you work across the continuum to make sure the standards, the certificate requirements are all nested well together? How do you create a unified data system for the whole system? How do you create an assessment set of assessment tools that work for great teaching and learning? That job of the Chief Education Officer is an important one and needs the ability to pull the agencies together. I will tell you that the agencies are ready. I've watched them. They will follow the leadership when you pass this bill to really help come together to build that system. And I think that's an important next step for this bill. So, in short, I think this is a great piece of legislation. I would highly recommend that you adopt it. It is not the end of this journey. It is one more step on a very long journey to improve education in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Duncan.
I forgot to get Ms. here. My name is Ruth Murray, and I am a teacher 40 years, and I am representing the Oregon Association of School Libraries. My comments had to do with just a very small part of this bill, because I've heard many good things that I like. The part is, as mentioned earlier, the compliance issue. We're worried about districts not complying with things they should be if they are excused from the reporting process. We passed a House Bill 2586 in 2010, which required strong school library programs. We fear that if the districts are not required to report about this, that it will be ignored, that they will put their efforts in other places. And because we feel very strongly about the importance of school libraries to reading and to all parts of education, we want to, I'm trying to summarize what I said. We're trying to make the suggestion that perhaps the compliance issue not be in the bill. It's a one-page sheet that they need to fill out in the districts, and we don't really feel like that's going to take up a lot of their time and resources to do.
Ruth, how long do you think it takes to fill out one of those forms?
I think depending on who they get to fill them out, if it's a group like it should be in the SIP process, it would probably take a few hours.
Thank you. Colleagues, any questions for this panel? Representative Frederick.
Thank you very much for allowing me to ask. Actually, it's more of a statement to Ruth, if possible. I would encourage you to make sure that the use of the library is part of the achievement compact. How much students are in fact reading, not how much they know on a multiple choice test, but how much they are in fact reading and taking the books out. So the next step is not just the recording, but also how much that we are actually seeing kids read, because we do know that if they are actually reading, then they're actually doing better, not just the test. So thank you. That's my comment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you very much.
Yes. A couple of issues have come up, and our original intent when we thought that we'd get through all this in just a much briefer amount of time was to have Tim come back and respond to the some of the concerns that were raised. But Tim, I'm going to ask you if you could to send an email to me or to Victoria and just responding to the questions about the budget and there was one about the excess use of testing, and I don't know, what else did we have? Something about the Division 22 reportings. If you could do that, and then I'll get them out to the committee as a whole. Okay, thank you very much. So with that, I'm going to bring to an end this information hearing on Senate Bill 1581, and I'm going to bring an end to this February 21st hearing of the House Committee on Higher Education. Thank you all for your patience and your attendance.